Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you may be. Welcome to CCNA Discovery 1, Chapter 3, Part 2, with Elise and Jackie on behalf of the Cisco Academy for the Vision Impaired. Now, I sincerely hope... I think we've got latency problems. Okay, because of stunts, I'm handing over to Jay to start the lecture while I do a bit more degatesing, so go for it, Jay. Oh, by the way, hello, how are you?
I'm wonderful. If I was any better, I'd have to be twins despite the gatesing. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, class. I'm going to start lecturing on 3.3.6 logical addressing. We may have covered that a little bit in last time's lecture, but it won't hurt to review. Oftentimes, in the concept of networking, we have to talk about two types of addressing. We have to talk about physical addressing, and we have to talk about logical addressing. And the two are very different. So what are the differences? Well, a physical address is often called a media access control or MAC address. The MAC address is actually burned into the network interface card at manufacture time. And so each card, supposedly, notice the word supposedly, has a unique MAC address or physical address. Think about physical, it's hardware. It's burned into the card, okay? A MAC address is somewhat like a person's name, maybe, although I don't even like that analogy. It's the analogy that Cisco uses. I don't like it because they say, well, a person's name usually doesn't change. Well, if you're a lady and if you're in most parts of the world and you get married, your name usually actually does change. So the analogy kind of falls apart at that point, probably proves to you that most men, most of the guys, the people who work at Cisco and wrote this stuff were males anyway. So that's the physical address. And here's the problem with physical addressing, is if you have 4 billion computers on one single network, and you're having to try to find somebody's MAC address throughout all of those computers, it could be a mill of a Hess. And that's the polite and edited version. And so we have to have something called a logical address. Basically, a logical address is very much akin to a person's home address. Okay? Obviously, a person can move, and therefore their home address can and often does change. So that's what that's all about. The logical address is actually called an IP address. And as you may remember from ITE1, an IP address is a 32-bit number, binary, really, if the truth be told. We tend to represent it in what's called dotted decimal notation, like 192.168.0.1. Each of those numbers represents a byte in binary, or 8 bits. Okay? So perhaps you remember that. The reason why it's known as a logical address is it's because it's assigned logically based on where the host is located. Sometimes this can be assigned by a network administrator based on the local network. The IP address can contain two parts. One part identifies the network on which the computer is located, and that will be the same for all hosts connected to the local network. And the second part of the IP address identifies the individual host on that network. So within the same local network, notice the terms within the same local network, the host portion is unique to each host. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, there are a lot of folks whose routers, for example, have an address of 192.168.0.1, as mine does. Okay, but we're all on separate networks, so each of those can have that address, and it does not create a problem. both a physical and logical address are going to be necessary in order for a computer to communicate on a hierarchical network. You remember last time Elise was talking about hierarchical networks, and she was talking about the diagram that had the continent of North America, and then it had the country of Canada, and the province of Nova Scotia, and the city of Halifax. And
I should be right now, guys.
Good. There was a street address in the city of Halifax that was highlighted. And so you can see that we go from a very broad type of a layer down to a very specific layer. And hierarchy of network represents the same concept, okay? What we're going to get into at this point, unless Elise wants to take over, is access and distribution layer and devices. Do you have it, Elise, or do you want me to continue?
Stand by. I was going to get you to continue all the way through to 3.0.
I will do that.
The end of 3.0, if you could. Yeah, sorry. Is that too much to ask?
Okay. Nope. Access,
thanks.
Layer distribution and devices. Okay. Let's talk about access layer. The access layer is basically the heart of how an individual accesses the network. The access layer then will transmit material, if need be, to the distribution layer, which then will send it, if necessary, to the core. And you will often see this if you run, like, Traceroute, for example. You can see the path that the network traffic takes from your computer throughout the internet to get to a particular site. And one of the words that you'll see kind of often in this Traceroute listing is the word core, and that's the third layer of what we're going to be talking about. So let's discuss the access layer. The access layer actually provides a connection point for end users to connect to the network. And it allows hosts to connect to other hosts through a network device, such as a switch or a hub. Typically, all of the hosts or devices in a network access layer will have the same portion of the network address. So what do I mean by that? Well, for example, let's talk about a network of 192.168.0.0. Okay, that is the network portion. From then on, the hosts will be from 1 to 254 with a proviso, and we'll talk about that. Actually, that's pretty much right, 1 to 254. So a host on that network, on the 192.168.0.0 network, would be 192.168.0.1 or 192.168.0.2, etc. That's not always the case for network addresses, and we'll get into that when we, you know, get into Chapter 5. We'll talk about how the, you know, these occur, but
just
for now, take my word for it that that this is the case in this particular network for now. Okay. Does anybody have any questions about that so far? If the message has its destination a local host, then the message remains local. It is not forwarded to any other networks. Okay. If, however, the message is designated for another network, then it has to go up through the distribution layer. So, for example, if my address, if I make some traffic, okay, if I send some traffic to Carl's, my husband Carl's computer, okay, it remains local to my network. It does not go out the internet port of my router. Okay, it just stays right here in my house. Okay, if on the other hand I send traffic to google.com, then it does have to go out to the distribution layer, and probably through the core layer actually, in order to reach google.com. Most of the time, the connection to the distribution layer is provided by hubs and switches. And the distribution layer device is usually a router. Now, if you happen to have, like most of us do, something called an integrated services router, which we will talk about in this chapter, actually, just a little bit later, then what happens is that the switches are still there, but they're internal, they're inside the box, and you don't see them. So just take my word for it, even if you have a router, there is actually some switching going on in order to reach the router. Okay? So that's the access layer. The access layer really is the heart of being able to access the network. Okay? Now we're going to discuss the distribution layer. The distribution layer typically contains more powerful switches than does the access layer, as well as, guess what, routers to route traffic between networks. In order, folks, in order, ladies and gentlemen, for you to have one network communicate with another network, you have to have a router. Test alert. Let me say it again. In order for you to be able to communicate with computers on another network, you must have a router. That includes the internet. Although, to some extent, you can actually do that by directly connecting to a modem. But that actually is a certain kind of router. Okay? Understand that routers actually are computers, and they have operating systems and stuff like that. That's a concept that a lot of students, you know, don't quite get, because it's not really talked about very much in networking. So they are computers, they do have operating systems, and they do have some intelligence. Okay? Distribution layers or devices actually control the types and amount of traffic that reaches the core layer. Now, the core layer is a high-speed backbone layer with redundant backbone connections. It really is the big, you know, daddy of them all. It's the kind of thing that can allow us to transmit across the ocean from the United States and reach a Ventrilo server in Perth, Australia, for example. That's facilitated by big, fat core layers, okay? It's responsible for transporting large amounts of data between multiple end networks. Core layer devices typically include very powerful switches and high-speed routers. The main goal of the core layer is to transport data quickly. All right. So what are some examples of access layer devices? Well, you can have IP phones, host computers, switches, and hubs. Distribution layer devices usually are just routers, and core layer devices are switch route processors. Okay, I'm at 3.4. Do you want me to continue? I'm assuming so. All right.
I'm starting at 3.5, hon.
The access layer, as I mentioned to you previously, is the most basic level of a network. It's composed of host devices and the first line of networking devices to which those hosts are attached. The network devices allow hosts to connect to each other and also provide a way for services to be provided and give hosts access to services over the network like email and internet, etc. Each host in an access network is connected to a networking device. So to bring it home to a small home office, for example, just to give you an example, Carl and I both have our own computers, because I don't like sharing my computer with a sighted person. Just not a good thing to have happen. And so both of these computers can connect to and use the internet at the same time. And the way that we do this is that we have a little router. It's an integrated services router, and it also has wireless connectivity. And in this case, we both use wireless connectivity, and we can, you know, connect to the internet over the same, connection. So it gives you an example of how that's done. Within an Ethernet network, if you have a wired Ethernet network, each host is connected to the device using a point-to-point cable. And a point-to-point cable means that it's plugged from your computer into the router. Now, my husband would kill me if I had cables strewn all over to connect computers up to the router, and I would probably end up killing myself tripping over them. So we use wireless. But it's very common in companies to have, computers connected to, like, patch panels and stuff like that. Or small things.
Well, even in my home office, I've got most of my stuff done by wiring because it's in the same room around the skirting boards. But once I go outside of the office, I like to use the wireless. We just won't tell the class about the fact I have got some floor mats down and a cable going out to the dining room for a friend's computer I'm servicing at the moment.
Well, I didn't. And so because you did... Ethernet cables have to meet...
It's not good practice,
standards.
Guys. Don't do it.
No, it is not good practice. It isn't. Likely to fall and break your head. Obviously, Ethernet... These cables have to be, manufactured to certain standards. And depending on, the environment which you find yourself, will dictate, what cable you need to get. Obviously, what happens is each cable is plugged into a host on the NIC and then to the network device. You've probably seen, most computers nowadays come with Ethernet cards integrated onto the motherboard. So I'm sure you've seen the RJ45 jacks on the computer. It kind of looks like a modem jack on steroids, if you remember from IT1, for those of you who took that. Several types of networking devices can be used to connect hosts at the access layer, and those include hubs and switches. A hub is a type of network device that's installed at the access layer of an Ethernet network. What they do is that they have multiple ports that you can connect hosts to the network in. So you can plug, several, depending on, how big the hub is, you can connect several computers to one of these hubs, rather like, one of these multiple USB port things that you can buy. Well, this is a hub that has Ethernet ports instead, RJ45 ports. Now, the thing of it is, hubs cannot decode messages. They receive the message and they spit it out. They do some amplification, but they cannot decode who it's to, etc. They just get it in, get it out, just regurgitate it pretty much. They can't determine, for example, which host should receive a particular message and that kind of thing. I tell you this because when we talk about switches, that's going to be different, and so you should understand the difference between these now. Like I said, a hub simply receives a message from one port called the source and just spits it out into all other ports, regardless of where it's going to. Now, what happens here is that the NIC, or the computer, will only accept a message to its own particular MAC address. So the hub spits it out on all other ports. The computers around see it. They say, this isn't mine. I don't have that MAC address. And the one whose MAC address it is says, that belongs to me. I'll take it. I'll accept it. So anyway, all of the hosts on an Ethernet hub actually are connected to the same channel. And so this is called a shared bandwidth channel. So a hub is referred to as a shared bandwidth device because each of the computers on the hub all have to transmit out that, that one network port. Basically, what it comes down to is that you have these ports coming in to the hub, but they only transmit out the one network port. Okay. Does anybody have any questions about this? As you can probably figure out, only one message can be sent through an Ethernet port at a time. If two hosts try to transmit at the same time, then the electronic signals of the messages collide with each other at the hub port. And what will happen is that the collision will cause the message to become garbled and unreadable. And the hub sends this messages out all of the other ports. So there's a collision, the message gets mangled. The hub, because it does not decode messages, says, I don't know, duh. I'm just going to send it out anyway because it doesn't understand that a collision has occurred. It sends it out all the other ports. This area...
Garbage in, garbage out, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. This area where a hub can receive a garbled message is called a collision domain. So, if four hosts are connected to a hub, that whole area of the four hosts that can receive a collision, a garbled message, is called a collision domain. When a host receives a garbled message, though, it detects that a collision has occurred. It says, the dumb hub spit out the damaged message, stupid cow of a thing. But I see that a collision has occurred. And therefore, what happens is that each sending host waits a short and usually randomized amount of time before trying to transmit again, very much the way humans do. You know, if the two of us interrupt each other, we'll stop and we'll say, sorry, E, or sorry, J, and we'll wait, and hopefully one of us will start speaking before the other one of us does, and we won't interrupt each other again. Sometimes that does not, in fact, happen, but sometimes it does. It's pretty obvious, and I think that you can all see, that as the number of hosts increases, so does the chance for collisions, obviously. And you can understand that excessive retransmission can, you know, clog up the network and slow down, you know, network traffic and performance. Therefore, it's very necessary to limit the size of a collision domain. Does everybody understand this?
Yes.
Yes.
Does anybody have any questions about it?
How are you going out there, Mario and Gary?
Okay. Doing fine.
Terrific.
All right, then let's go on. Now that we've talked about hubs, and I told you that they just, you know, basically... in and out, they spit, they regurgitate, whatever you want to say. Let's talk about switches a little bit, because switches are a bit more sophisticated. In one sense, a switch is like a hub in that they connect multiple hosts to a network. They can connect, you know, many computers to the network. But unlike a hub, a switch can actually forward a message to a specific host. So this is not, I'm going to spit it out all the other ports and the right person will pick it up, okay? The hub is a slacker. The switch is a worker, all right? When a host, what happens is that when a host sends a message to another host on the switch receives it first, okay? The switch then decodes the message in order to read the physical MAC address of the destination host of the device for which the message is intended. There's a table on the switch called a MAC address table, and that contains a list of all of the active ports on the switch and the MAC address of the host that's attached to that particular port. So, if I have, you know, 192.168.1 through 192.168.10, and they're connected to a switch, and 192.168.2 wants to communicate with 196.168.0.1, because it's a router, then it sends the message, the switch gets it, says, I know Mr. Router, It has a logical address of 192.168.0.1, although it doesn't really deal with the logical addressing. But it says, I know its MAC address, I have it in my table, and it's AAAAA, you know, it's, I'm not going to go into that, but it knows what the MAC address is, and it forwards it on. So the switch first checks, if it gets a message, it checks to see if the MAC address is in the table. And if it is, it just builds a temporary connection between the source and the destination ports. This temporary connection is known as a circuit, and it's not shared. It's private. It's like the switch says, I'm going to let the source and the destination computers or hosts, whatever it is, have a little private conversation all to themselves here. So it's actually a dedicated channel. So the other hosts don't share bandwidth with it, because each time a host wants to communicate with another host, a separate, you know, circuit or channel is built. So the bandwidth is not shared. And so, obviously, these circuits can allow many conversations to take place at the same time, and collisions don't occur. Does anybody have any questions about that?
One question that might pertain to the, the hub. Unless there's a huge difference in cost, what's the advantage, if there is one, of using a hub instead of a switch?
These days, virtually none.
Yeah, because the switches have really come down in price. It used to be that a hub was more expensive. But nowadays, with the price of electronics coming down, it's really to one's advantage.
It's got to be way more efficient, doesn't it? Because it doesn't create those collisions.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I wouldn't even consider buying a hub for my needs now. I've got a Shorecom switch that I bought 6 years ago. It's now back under my desk. It sort of comes and goes, which is what we're sort of making, just because I want more Ethernet ports. And I think that cost only $54 about 6 years ago, so they're probably even cheaper now.
In fact, I think Ian not long ago was offering switches to those on the list for the price of shipping.
I have a feeling it was too. Yeah. So.
Hubs really aren't very efficient anymore. I mean, I guess they do cost less. They do, but as far as I'm concerned, given the efficiency of a switch, that's what is worth getting. Any other questions about this? All right, so we've talked about what happens when the switch has the entry in its MAC address table. What happens if it doesn't? What happens if a new host connects to the network and the switch it receives a message intended for a destination, and it looks it up in the MAC address table and says, uh-oh, this ain't here. I don't have this one. The switch cannot create, at this point, it cannot create an individual circuit between the source and the destination because it doesn't have the particular MAC address that it needs. And so what it will do is it uses a process called flooding. And what flooding is it just sends a message out to all of the hosts that are connected to it with a frame that contains the MAC address of the computer it wants the MAC address for, or the destination host, whatever it is. It doesn't have to be a computer, right? So it sends it out to all of the ports, and it says basically the equivalent of, yo, whoever has the MAC address of da 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 da, please reply. And that's pretty much what happens. The person, the host receives the message, says, that's my MAC address. It's like being called, you're in a room and somebody calls, yo, Gary! Gary Jackson will probably, his ears will perk up, and everybody else sitting around here, like in class, will just ignore that. And so they'll, they reply and say, yeah, that's mine, and accept it. And so at that point, you know, the switch knows that this is the MAC address of the host that it wants to send a message. Does anybody have any questions about that? When a switch, the switch builds the MAC address table by examining the source MAC address of every message that's sent between hosts. So it looks and says, ah, that message is coming from MAC address, you know, whatever, okay? And so what it happens is that when the host responds to a flood, you know, a request for a MAC address, or sends a message, then the, you know, switch says, ah, here's this MAC address, here's what port it's connected to, and it puts it into a table. Again, switches are small computers. They do have some intelligence, unlike a hub, you know, which really doesn't. And so they're able to, you know, at least do this amount of processing. The table, the MAC address table, is actually updated dynamically every time the message from a source or sender host is read by the switch. And so the switch very quickly learns the, you know, the MAC addresses of all of the hosts attached to it. Okay. Sometimes you have to connect another networking device like a hub to a switch port. And when that happens, then trouble starts all over again. This is obviously done to increase the number of hosts that can be connected to the network. But here's the thing. If you connect a hub and then connect a bunch of PCs to that hub, let's just say PCs for simplicity's sake right now, what happens is that the switch does not know what the MAC addresses of those PCs are that's connected to the hub. All it does is say, ah, this hub is connected to me, and associate the MAC address of the hub, okay? So what will happen is if, let's say that I have PC1, PC2, PC3, PC4 connected to a switch, and I also have a hub with PC5, PC6, PC7, and PC8 connected to the hub. And PC1 needs to send a message to PC8. What will happen is that the switch says, ah, this is not directly connected to me, but the hub is directly connected to me. So I will send this message to the MAC address of the hub, and then the hub will spit it out on all the ports. And then PC8 says, oh, I recognize this. This is my MAC address. I'll accept this message. And the rest of the hosts on the hub say, oh, it's not mine. I'm not even going to mess with it. And that's what happens in a situation like that. So, unfortunately, what can happen is, obviously, that collisions can occur on the hub. And so the hub, in that case, with all of its PCs connected to it, is your collision domain. Obviously, if the source and destination are located on the same, you know, switch, for example, like if PC1 is sending to PC3, then obviously, you know, the switch forwards from PC1 to PC3. Now, if a collision occurs on the hub, the switch receives the garbled message, right? The switch receives the garbled message, but it doesn't transmit it. It says, oh man, a collision occurred. I'm not, you know, transmitting this. So every switch port basically creates a separate, you know, collision domain. And we've already gone over to the fact that the fewer hosts that are contained in a collision domain, the less likely collisions will occur. Okay, does everybody understand this?
Yeah.
I have either put everybody to sleep.
Well, I know Kylie understands it because we were talking about it 2 weeks ago, so there's one student that's got a grasp of it. So how are you going there, Gary, with all that? Everyone else has got glazed eyes?
I follow it, I suppose.
Well, you can always grab us off channel or review the notes or stop us and ask us questions.
Or download the lecture.
Yeah, it makes enough sense to me.
So, let's...
I don't know if this has gone...
Oh, go
ahead, Gary.
I don't know if this is going too far ahead yet or not like that, but I was wondering if a switch can be connected to a switch as well.
And they are.
Yep. And most integrated services routers have a 4-port switch built into them, as I think did earlier. And on one of those ports on my one is my Shawcom switch, which I just reinstalled yesterday because I need some Ethernet out to the living room. So I can fix Jillian's computer on it. So, yes, they are switches connected to a switch.
It happens a lot.
Obviously, we're physically...
You go ahead, Gary.
I have a router, a separate router. I have a Linksys.
You saw an instance of a collision.
particularly, I'm still on Wi-Fi, and if I'd remembered that I'd done this, because Jillian's computer is just sitting over here, and if it is going to cause problems, I'll shut down the Wi-Fi and come up on the bit of Ethernet that's coming out here to the dining room. Yeah, in actual fact, it's quite pleasant sitting out here in the dining room, lots of sunshine. Go ahead, Gary. You were about to say that you had a Linksys. It sounds like some type of router that you're using with your cable mode.
I do, yes. Yeah, obviously we're physically limited to 4 ports, as you were talking about, the 4-port switch, but if you're operating wireless also, because I've got a couple of computers here connected wirelessly, does that, in a sense, give you unlimited, or does it still limit you to 4 devices?
Well, it broadens your horizons a bit. Eventually you're going to end up having a few collisions and stuff on the Wi-Fi, and you could find that every time you put a host on Wi-Fi, you'll find that the efficiency will drop by a bit. A good case in point might be over at Jackie's place when I go. She said before her and Carla are on there, it won't do any harm to add me when I'm there visiting. But if there were 30 of me, there could be a problem. So, no, you'd be right. You can still have, say, for example, I've got on my 4-port router here, a 4-port integrated services router. I've got a VoIP box. I've got Challenger, which is my Linux server. I've got my spare machine, which is not even booting properly at the moment. Plus, I've got the 4-port switch, which then extends the capability to my main machine, which I'm not on at the moment because of all the gatesing audio, and Jillian's machine, and if possible, probably the Triple E PC as well if I wanted it. Plus, I've still got the Wi-Fi, which then can handle this machine, which is what you're hearing me through at the moment, the machine in the bedroom, if that was powered up and turned on, which is what I read the notes on last night while I was in bed, and the internet radio. So, yeah, having that extra expandability, I'm not limited. I've still got some, I've got some room to grow here. Plus, I've got another 6 or 7 ports on the Shawcom switch I could use as well. So, theoretically, the Linksys router should be able to cope with all of that.
You can limit the amount of devices that connect wirelessly, too.
You can, and we'll talk about some of that in Chapter 7.
Okay.
You know, what begins to happen, though, is that the more hosts that are connected to the network, especially if broadcast traffic, needs to be sent, the more performance is going to degrade over time. And you may well reach a point where that degradation is not graceful, if you understand my point. Actually, Windows XP...
Yeah, while...
we had another collision.
Windows another XP, one, because I've got latency.
Yeah, you do have latency, and we have latency from you, in case you're wondering. Windows XP really only allows for about 10 connections in a peer-to-peer. After that point, things just go... So, actually, I think it's a licensing thing more than a connectivity thing. But that's about what they allow. Okay. So, broadcast messages. If you have hosts connected either using a hub or a switch, it creates a single local area network. Okay? A single local area network. Sometimes it becomes necessary for one host to, send a message to all other hosts at the same time. And this can be done using a message known as broadcast messages. Okay? So a broadcast is very much like what you get with a radio broadcast. It's sending to all of those who are tuned in to the station. Okay? Well, this is like the same thing. It sends to all of those who are on this particular local area network. This happens, like, for example, if a host needs to find out information without knowing which of the hosts on the network can supply it. We'll get into this when we talk about, DHCP servers, etc. But this is what this is for. If a host says, oh man, I need a DHCP server, but I don't know who my DHCP server is, it can send a broadcast message to find out. It can also be used when a host needs to provide other hosts information, such as, you know, I'm the server and I'm up, or whatever it is. But here's the problem. A message can only contain one destination MAC address. So how are we going to implement a broadcast to every host? Here's the thing. There's an unique MAC address that's recognized by all hosts as a broadcast address, and it contains all ones. It's a 48-bit MAC address containing nothing but ones. 48 ones. Obviously, this is going to be represented as in hexadecimal location because it's not convenient to write out all that many all that many ones. So what we get is four, well, it's a triplet of four Fs is what it is. So it's FFFF times 3. That's what the MAC address would look like in hexadecimal notation for a broadcast address. I stopped a minute because I wasn't quite sure how to describe it to you. I hope that was an adequate description. Was it?
Considering the way it's written in the notes, yes.
Look, here's what you have to understand. When you're looking at a hex number, it's called a nibble. Each hex number is called a nibble. A nibble represents half a byte. That's why we call it a nibble. It's not a byte.
It's crazy, isn't it?
Okay, it is crazy, but that's how it is. Okay, and so each of these represents 4 bytes. And so if it's 48 bits, then what we have to have is 12 nibbles, right? And so it's divided up into these triplets, because the numbers have to end on an even boundary in order to represent bytes. So, you know, each of the triplets basically represents, you know, 16 bits or 2 bytes. Does that make sense to everybody, or have I just served to confuse you more?
No, it sounds okay.
Okay. When a host receives a broadcast address, you know, when one of the hosts on the network receives a broadcast address, it just says, that's for me, and processes it. Obviously, you know, when a hub or a switch receives a broadcast address, it forwards it to every port that's connected to it, on the, you know, that would be on the same local network. And therefore, another name for a local network is a broadcast domain, okay? A broadcast domain. Because all hosts on that particular local network receive that broadcast, okay? And we've already told you what can happen if too many hosts are connected to the same broadcast domain. You know, traffic can slow down and degrade significantly. The amount of, you know, the number of hosts that can actually physically be connected to the local network and not degrade, you know, performance is basically dependent on the capability of the network devices, the switch and the hubs. And obviously it's, you can see what happens if too many, you know, hosts get on the same network. Because of this, it's often necessary to divide one local network into segments in order to, you know, improve performance. I'm at 3.4.5. Still want me to continue, E?
I'm happy to take over if you like. Give yourself a break. You've gone for about an hour now, so thank you.
I'm sure they're more than getting tired of listening to me palaver.
You're not blabbering. Oh, well, these are long sections. We didn't mark it up at the sub-levels. We marked it up at the chapters this fortnight, and it's really made it a long slog, didn't it? We'll do it different next week, I think. Okay, so how's everyone going with what Jay said so far? We're travelling all right, folks?
Yep.
Yeah.
Great. Excellent.
Yes.
So we were talking about access layer, and by the way, switches are for people who are more familiar with the OSI reference model, the Open Systems Interconnect model, which we talk about in the other courses, as well as we have to wait for Chapter 6 in this. Switches are layer 2 devices, folks, because they deal with framing and that sort of stuff. In the new age of discovery, we talk about this access, distribution and core layer stuff, and Jackie's just talked a lot about the access layer. Now, if I can just find my place, which is 3.5, building the distribution layer, the next level up. Pretty much what it says here. Yes, Jay? Oh, okay. You haven't finished 3.4 yet. Sorry.
Obviously, we've already talked about the fact that on a local Ethernet network, the NIC only accepts the frame if the address is either a broadcast address or its own. Most network applications, though, rely on the logical IP address, not the MAC address, to identify the location of the server and client. So what happens if the server or the sending host only has the IP address? What happens then? You know, because that's a problem. You know, it's like, okay, I have this person's IP address, but gee, I don't have the MAC address, and so it can't really get to its destination. What happens is that there is a protocol called Address Resolution Protocol, or ARP, A-R-P, Address Resolution Protocol, to discover the address of the host located on the same local network. So what happens is that ARP uses a three-step process when only the IP address is known. The sending host actually says, okay, I don't know the MAC address, so it sends a message to a broadcast MAC address, you know, what we talked about, 11111, okay? Contained within that message frame is the IP address of the intended destination host, of the host that this host, you know, wants to send to. Each host on the network receives this broadcast message and compares the destination IP address and says, that is not mine, or yeah, it is mine. And in that case, the host that says it is mine sends its MAC address back to the sending host, and then the sending host receives that reply from the destination host and puts it in a table called an ARP table. And once the sending host has the MAC address, then it can send the frames directly, the messages directly, without doing an ARP request. Now, I'm done, and it's your turn.
Can I please just ask a question? So the difference between a MAC address tables are held only by switches, and ARP tables can be held by hosts as well, is that right?
Sorry, your audio is a little okay, I didn't...
Sorry, so MAC address tables are held by switches, and ARP tables are held by anyone on the network, difference?
Yeah.
Got it, thank you.
Yeah, got it, yeah. Your Windows will have an ARP table. What is an ARP / something rather gives it to you, I think?
Yeah, I think it's ARP / A.
Sounds about right.
Any other questions before I turn it over to Elise for, you know, to take this away and get myself a drink of water or something? Which is a disguised term for play with my book. I mean, no, it isn't.
We all happy? All right. I tell you what, this Ventrilo is so low, even though I've cranked all the volumes. It's been almost like listening to you through a crystal set for the last hour, Jay. It's been absolutely hard. I don't know what it is with these headphones. And it seems to be getting lower, too. So, at the risk of messing it up, I'm not going to play with it anymore. But yours seems to be nice and comfortable to listen to, and that's all that matters for me. So, if you want to ask a question, yell loud. Okay. As networks grow, it's often necessary to... I'll ask Jay, because I'll probably hear her talking anyway. Okay, now next door's going to fire. Good on you. The sound out of him for an hour, and here he goes as soon as I open the mic. There's pretty much many ways of dividing networks based on different criteria. We're now talking about the distribution layer, and I will go and shut the front door. Hang on. Okay. Physical location is one of the things that we have to take into account. Logical function, security requirements. Basically, the distribution layer connects these smaller independent networks and manages the traffic that flows between them. It's basically also responsible for the traffic on local networks that stays local. That's why we use this three-layered approach. Pretty much only traffic that is destined to other networks is passed on through the distribution layer. The distribution layer of a network can also filter incoming and outgoing traffic for security and management. Basically, networking devices that make up the distribution layer are designed to connect many networks and not individual hosts. So we're talking at the level that Jackie was just talking about with the switches and the hubs. We're talking at the access layer, and we're talking at the next level up here. So she was connecting hosts together. And it basically says exactly what I just said, so we'll take the repetition out of it. Yeah, the access layer devices are connected to each other through routers. So this is where we talk about connecting networks to other networks. For example, in your home environment, you're talking about connecting your home internal network, like my network here with my switch and my machines and my VoIP box, to the big, bad, nasty internet, and that's done by means of a router or a distribution layer device. Or layer 3 if we're talking OSI. Now we've got this broadcast containment here. Routers in the distribution layer can limit broadcasts to the lower level layer where they need to be heard. In other words, any traffic from, say, this triple EPC back to the main system, being Challenger, won't go outside my local network because the router sits here and goes, no packets are destined to outside. So the document I'm actually reading from is actually on Challenger, which is my Linux server, across the Wi-Fi to my triple EPC out on the dining room table. So there's no need for any of that traffic to go out to the outside network, other than the Ventrilo packets, of course, which have been sent out to the internet for you to hear. Although broadcasts are necessary, too many hosts on the local network can generate excessive broadcast traffic and slow down the network performance. Routers in the distribution layer can give you a level of security and can separate and protect different groups of computers where confidential information resides. Now, in a large company, for example, we may have different routers between different little networks or subnets within the same company, and that would sort of fence off the accounts department from maybe the sales department or the client database or something like that to keep a level of security. Routers can also hide the internal addresses of your local computers from the outside world to help prevent attacks, and that's exactly what your network address translation does on your integrated services router. It also controls who can get into and out of the local network. I actually had to open some ports here to allow my VoIP box to work correctly, and I think I did for Fidelity Phone for when Jackie and I watch movies and do other things over the internet, like play a golf game. I've got a port open there for that Fidelity Phone program to use. We'll come back to all that sort of stuff later in the course.
Tell them what happened to your friend.
Yes, I was wondering when we can build that up. And Kylie and Jackie know about this. A friend of mine's got a VoIP box, very, very similar system to what I've got here over the road in Chadston, and she decided that she would troubleshoot her VoIP box without me. And she rang up some help desk, either at the VoIP box provider or the internet service provider, and they set up a DMZ. And it was interesting to note the fact that the DMZ worked on all ports across all protocols, which means, she got a VoIP.
For demilitarized zone?
Yep. She got a VoIP service working.
It's people, it's DMZ.
Sorry, Jay? Oh, of course, sorry, folks. DMZ. The Yanks, yeah. Sorry, Yanks. Okay, so we set up a DMZ, and basically what happened was, she set up a DMZ, and it also opened port 80. Now, most of these VoIP boxes, like the routers, have a web-based interface so that you can open, you know, type in its URL or its local address into your web browser, and you can configure it. Well, that's all very good on your local network. Isn't that sweet? It's rather interesting when it gets out on the big, bad, nasty internet, and my friend Craig tracked it, and he goes, I think I know what that IP address is. It's coming from my friend Vicky, and he decided to check what was on port 80, didn't he? Well, wasn't he surprised when he sat there and found a Sapura VoIP box with all her telephone numbers in it and the record of what she'd been up to and no password on it, and wouldn't it have been very nice if somebody had gone there and hacked around with her VoIP box? So that's a DMZ, and that we can imagine as soon as we got wind of that, we closed it off very quickly for her and said, next time you try and troubleshoot your devices, listen to what's been said to you, and also make sure you shut down any DMZs or DMZs that you set up in the process of troubleshooting. So, therefore, in the case of that router, she negated any of the security and the network address translation that was on that router, and it just everything went straight in and out of that particular internal IP address. Okay, so that's an interesting point. Does that make sense, guys, what I just said?
Yeah, so much for shielding the local network and security.
What was that, Jackie?
I said so much for shielding the local network and security.
Oh, absolutely. The function of routers. Okay, basically a router is a local networking device that connects your network to other networks. These direct traffic and perform other functions critical to network operations. Routers, like their switches, are able to decode messages that are sent to them. Unlike switches that only decode the frame, the routers can actually get down to the packet level, so the packets are inside the frame. So they all decode the frame and work out about, you know, the addressing and that sort of stuff. So switches will do frames at the higher level, and the routers can actually get in a little bit deeper and see what's going on at the frame level. Okay, the packet format contain the IP addresses of the destination and source hosts, as well as the message data being sent between them. So in other words, one host on 192.168.1.2 might send a message to another host on another network somewhere else, and it looks at both the source and the destination IP address and figures it out at that level. And we are now talking layer 3 devices, if I've not already mentioned that for those of you who are involved in the OSI reference model, which is pretty good when you get to know it. Okay, the router reads the network portion of the IP address and uses it to find which of the attached networks is the best way to forward the packets. Okay, any time that the network portion of your IP address is of the same source and destination... I'll read that again. Okay, here we go. Any time that the network portion of the IP address from the source and destination do not match, that's when a router needs to be used, and the router can actually figure it out. Okay, the network on 1.1.1.0 needs to send a message to a network on, say, 5.5.5.0, even though it's not quite a valid IP address, it will use the router to do it. Basically, the router receives the message, unencapsulates it or unwraps it to read the destination IP address, and then determines where to forward the message. Basically, it re-encapsulates the packet back into a frame and forwards that frame onto its destination. Okay, we've got a diagram here, and I'll do my best to try and describe it, turn it into words. There's a diagram here in the notes that depicts a packet encapsulated inside an Ethernet frame. The Ethernet frame consists of the MAC address, as we discussed earlier, moving from left to right, followed by the source MAC address. This hasn't been formatted properly. The destination and source MAC addresses are read by layer 2 devices, as Jackie discussed before, such as a switch or a bridge. Now, I'm not going to read all this. This is very similar to what Jackie read before, and I'm going to refer you to your notes because it's just not going to come out properly if I have to sort of read it and copy it into words. We've also got some formatting issues with this document. Okay, so after the sort of MAC address fields, we then look at the IP addressing fields. And these are the destination and source IP addresses. Now, depending on the subnet mask, which we'll discuss in Chapter 5, some bits of the IP address belong to the network and some bits belong to the host. And if we're talking, let's say, Class C, which are 192.168.1 type addresses, those three octets are network, and the last group of octets, or the last octet, sorry, is your host address. So it gives an example here of, say, 192.168.1.5. First three octets, is, as I just said, are network, and the five is your host. In addition to the source and destination IP address, the packet also contains, it also contains, yes, you guessed it, the user data, the all-important bit that you need to read. The data is offered as the payload. The last part of the Ethernet frame is what's known as the trailer, and the trailer finishes the encapsulation of the frame. How does the router determine what destination path it needs? Let's find out. Each port or interface on a router connects to a different local network, and every router contains a table of every locally connected networks or network interfaces that connect to them, so routers know about each other, which is good. These are known as routing tables, and they can contain information about the routes and paths that the router must use. As we know, when a router receives a frame, it decodes the frame to get the packet, and the packet contains the destination IP address. Okay, it matches that destination IP address to all of the addresses that are contained in its own routing table. If the address is found in the table, the router will re-encapsulate the packet in a new frame in order to send it out. Basically forwards it out the correct interface associated with the path to the correct network. The process of forwarding these packets to their destination network is, you guessed it, the process known as routing. Okay, router interfaces do not forward packets. Oh yeah, router interfaces do not forward packets that are the messages that are forwarded to the, what have we got here, broadcast address. It's the broadcast MAC address, so they don't go forwarding those type of messages. Okay, I'm going to try and describe another diagram for you. I'm somewhat conscious about time. I might actually refer you to the notes on that one, because I know Kylie and I were discussing it recently, and I think she read it to me quite well. It's quite easy to understand, even if you've got to read it with jaws a few times. How are we coping with this business of routers getting down to the packets and actually looking at the source and destination IP address, folks?
Yep, fine.
Thanks, Kylie. How are you going with all that, Gary and Mario?
Fine.
Seems to be okay, but I do recall since I took Discovery last semester that this chapter is a killer, and some of the questions will trick you up.
Yeah, we're actually in part two of it there. I know this is a hard chapter, and that's why we're hoping to sort of layer this, because what we've done is we've come down a level from that, the one that Jackie was reading, and we're now at the packets. It is a killer. It's one of the two hardest, the chapter 3 and chapter 5 are the tricky ones for people who are new to Discovery. You're so right. I might leave the... how am I going to go with this? This is not going to come out terribly well if I translate this into words. I can tell you where each one's connected to different parts of it. So I'm going to refer you to your notes for this.
If it helps, I found the diagrams actually quite confusing and really relied on the text to try and understand what was happening.
Yeah, you do. Well, I'll see what I can do about talking it through. There's... six hosts. Look, it's just gonna confuse the living daylights out of me. I think we've got some hosts like host 5 and host 6 connected via a switch, and all the other hosts are actually connected directly to the router. But basically what they're trying to illustrate here is how that the packets are sent through this circuit. Basically what it says here, basically a message is forwarded through the network based on the switch. The switch examines the MAC address table to see if the entry is on the local network. If the MAC is not found, the packet will be forwarded to the default gateway. Then a router comes in and examines the routing table to see if the IP address exists in its IP table. Once the path has been determined, the router sends out the correct interface to the correct network. Default gateway. Now, we've probably seen this before when we've connected our internet you know, when we've got our systems back on the internet, we must supply default gateway, because if you don't, you'll be able to talk to your local machines, but you won't be able to talk to the big, bad, nasty internet, and some people might like that. So basically what it says here, the way the messages are sent are different when we're talking about going out to another network. Okay, when a host needs to send a message to it... Go ahead, Jay.
I was just going to tell a story about that.
Go for it.
I went on vacation last summer to a hotel down in Casa Grande. Husband Carl had some kind of a ministry conference to attend, and I went along for the ride, and I wanted to connect to the internet, and lo and behold, I could connect. And I had just finished Discovery, and I said, if I cannot fix this, I'm going to be really upset with myself. So I got to looking, and lo and behold, the problem was the default gateway. It was configured for 192.168.0.1, which was not the default gateway in the hotel. And once I made the changes to delete that default gateway, we connected up very well, thank you. And so that's the importance of the default gateway right there.
And that's the importance of doing Discovery, because you can fix these little problems for yourself or go fix them when they occur to your friends or clients, if you want to start chatting.
Yeah, not have to call tech support and get some kind of a runaround.
Have you checked your browser settings? Yeah, exactly. You can do quite a lot for yourself with this course. It's really good. Okay, when a host needs to send a message to another host located on the same network, it will forward the message directly. A host will use ARP, ARP to discover the MAC address of another host. It includes the IP address into the packet and encapsulates all this nice little packet into a frame. And the contain contains, yes, you guessed it, the MAC address of the destination. On the other hand, when a host needs to send a message to a remote network, it must use the router. The host includes the IP address of the destination host within the packet, just like it did before. However, when it encapsulates this packet into a frame, it uses the MAC address. Of the router as the destination for that. This is formatting gone really crook. As the destination for the frame. So basically, it uses the MAC address of your local router for the destination of the frame. In this way, your router will receive the request or the message based on the frame or the MAC address in the frame. And sort it out. Now, how does the source host determine the MAC address of your router? Okay, the host, or your host, in other words, your computer, is given the IP address via means of having the default gateway in the TCP/IP settings. So, your default gateway is usually the IP address of the router, and that's how it knows what to do. So, it is all important to have that IP, that default gateway IP there. Basically, the default gateway is the address of the router, of the router interface connected to your host. In other words, it's the IP address of the near side interface of the local router, is what we often say. I'm not going to read it out of here. All hosts use the same default gateway. So all of the systems here on my network, all the ones that are up and running, Challenger in the other room, Enterprise in the other room, which I can hear my voice coming back from, Jillian's machine when it's powered up, this Triple E PC, default gateway gateway address, which is 192.168.1.254. which is the address of my router. Okay, once the host knows the default gateway address, it can use ARP to determine the MAC address that it needs, which is the MAC address of my router. The MAC address is then put back in the frame, destined for another network. Okay, and it just basically reiterates what we've said. It's important to make sure the default gateway is configured, and if no gateway is configured, or in the case of Jackie, if it was incorrect, then you're not going to get it. I'll skip the diagram because it basically just reiterates what I just said. Tables that are maintained by routers. Routers move information between local and remote networks. To do this, routers must use both ARP and routing tables. Routing tables are not concerned with addresses of individual hosts. Routing tables contain instead other network addresses and the best path to those networks. Entries can be made to your routing table in two ways. Dynamically, one, dynamically updated from other routers in the network, or two, manually entered by a network administrator. If a router can't determine what a message to, yep, guess what happens? It drops it. A network administrator can configure a routing table with a default route to keep a message from being dropped because the destination path is not in the routing table. So network administrators have a lot of power here, and I think a lot of this is done in Discovery too, where you actually log in and configure the routers. A default route or default route
is... an important question about the default route.
Yep, go ahead, Jay.
Test away.
The default route is the interface through which the router forwards a packet containing an unknown destination IP address. This route usually connects to another router that can forward the packet to its final destination network. Another diagram here that I'm going to really mess up on if I try and describe it, so please read the notes up here in chapter 3.5. Basically, the two tables that are kept and updated by the router are the address resolution protocol, or ARP, and the routing table. So they're the things you really have to take from this particular part of the chapter. The entries into these tables are listed below, so let's see how we go with this. ARP table. Address, hardware, and interface. Oh, good grief, it's going to just give nothing but numbers, and I'm just going to tangle this up if I've got to read this with JAWS, so have a look at the notes, and really, really reread this a couple of times, and come back and discuss it with us on Skype if you need to. A router forwards the frame to one of two places, a directly connected network containing the actual destination host, or to another router on the path to the destination host. When a router encapsulates a frame to forward it out of an interface, it must include a destination MAC address. This is the MAC address of the actual destination host. If the destination host is part of a network, is part of the network directly connected to the router. If the router has to forward the packet to another router, it will use the MAC address of that other router. And of course, as we now have discovered, routers obtain these MAC addresses from their address resolution protocol table, or ARP table. Each router has to contain their own ARP table. Now I'll just paraphrase some of this because it just gets quite repetitive, doesn't it? Okay, I'm just going to skip another diagram because by the time I try and correlate that into words, it's going to mangle. How are we going with all this? Because I realise for people it's quite a lot of new concepts here. Okay, here we go. We've got one of these. H1 says,
hello.
H1 says I need to send a packet to 192.168.1.3. That IP is in my local network. Wacko. The IP and MAC addresses are in my ARP table. Like we said, Windows knows about this too. I'm going to forward the message directly. It's in the local network. It says here, note that the packet does not leave the local network. And yeah, same any communications between Challenger, which has got this Word document, and the client machine, which is this Triple EPC reading the Word document, is just simply between Challenger and the Triple EPC, not between the internet and anything else that's going on. Nor is it between the actual enterprise, which is also sitting here in the middle of it all too. Okay, we have another scenario here where host 4 turns around and says, I need to send a packet to 192.168.2.1, which is on another network. Okay, I'm going to have to send this packet to my default gateway first because this 192.168.2.1 IP address isn't here on my local network segment. So I'm going to have to send it out. I'm going to have to talk to my local gateway to have this one dealt with. Wacko, I've got the default gateway and MAC address of my router in my ARP table. Right, I know where to send it, and I'll let the router figure it out. Okay, the router 1 says this host is directly on a network, is on a network. Is on a network directly on one of my other interfaces. I will check. I will check my own up table. Whoa, there he is. I'm going to send it over there now. So therefore, the router's got control of the message. Okay, we've got 3.5.5 local area networks or LANs. How are we going for time, gang? 20 minutes, and I'm determined to get Chapter 3 done in 2 weeks. What do you think, Jay?
Well, let's try it.
Okay, here we go, because I really not to do this, wanted to do this over 3. Okay. Okay, the term LAN, or local area network, refers to a group of networks that are under the same administrative control. Now, once upon a time when we were growing up, Jay and I, a LAN was usually referred to as the local area network within a building, or a part of a building, but no, it's whoever's got a local administrative control. So a LAN now can stretch from one building to another building now. If it's the same people running it, it's usually referred to as the local area network. And it actually says that here in the early days, LANs were defined as small networks existing in a single physical location. Okay, we can still have a LAN in the small office, home office environment. Basically now, LANs have really evolved to being, you know, larger networks containing many numbers of, hundreds of hosts. Basically the biggest thing, and I think this is a test question if I remember rightly from my days as a student, the important thing to remember, a LAN is a network under the one administrative control. Other characteristics are that LANs typically use Ethernet or wireless protocols, and they support high data rates. The term intranet is often used, that's intranet. It's usually referred to as a private LAN that belongs to an organisation and that is only designed to be accessible by the organisation's members, employees or staff. Now, you can actually have a web server running on an intranet serving up web pages. A lot of organisations do. Even 12 or so years ago when I was working at Hewlett-Packard, they had an intranet and that had all the help tips and stuff for us at the help desk. It was only seen by people within Hewlett-Packard, or probably even more specifically in my part of Hewlett-Packard. So there you go. But we talked to it with Netscape Navigator or Internet Explorer or whatever we had at the time. Another diagram. Have a look at your notes, because we're going to rock it through this. Yeah, I'm going to ask you to study up on the notes. You may need to read them a couple of times. So I'm not going to try and relate this, because I'll only confuse you. Adding hosts to local and remote networks, 3.5.6. Within a LAN, it's possible to put hosts on a single local network. I'll divide them up into different networks separated by distribution layer. Device. Now the answer to this, how you lay out your network, is really dependent on desired results. You know, if you've got many floors of a company, it's going to be a good idea to maybe segment it off in different floors or different areas, or put the sales in one area and the sort of marketing department in another area and the management in some other area. So this is where network planning becomes important. If you can put all the hosts on a single network or a single network segment, you will allow them to be seen by all other hosts and clutter up the network with a lot of broadcast traffic. And this is referred to as a broadcast domain. In a simple network design, such as what I have here, it is beneficial to keep all hosts in the same network domain. I mean, to say, let's put this way, I can have 254 hosts on this segment, so I'm not going to have a problem if I just have how many are here at the moment. Turned on at the moment, there's 3 hosts, and there can be anything up to about 5 or 6. So obviously as networks grow in size, the network performance will decrease. In this instance, it will be beneficial to remove hosts onto another network. However, hosts on one network will not be able to communicate with hosts on another. Whoa. Here we go, the thought plickens. How are we going to deal with this? We introduce routers. So this is where the routers actually, you know, we introduce routing. Now, these routers do increase the network complexity and can introduce latency with packets sent from one local network to another, but we need them. Another diagram here, refer to your notes. Just scan past those. Okay, now if I remember rightly, there's some advantages and disadvantages here, so let's have a look. I'm assuming here they're talking about single networks here because it's not formatted well. So we're looking at advantages.
I think it's peer-to-peer.
Yeah, okay, I would say this is advantages of simple networks where all hosts are visible to each other. And the advantages, of course, are appropriate for simpler networks such as home office, small office environments. Less complexity, lower network costs. Allows devices to be seen by other devices. Faster data transfer because of more direct communications. And ease of device access. Disadvantages of a small, everything on the one network type job. All hosts are in one broadcast domain, which causes a lot of broadcast traffic and could slow network of performance. Okay, now we move to LANs with hosts on different networks. Okay, we talk about another diagram here. Okay, the advantage of these types of networks is that it's appropriate for more larger and complex networks like a company or corporation. Splits up splits up broadcast domains. Yes, that's what we need. Because we've split up the broadcast domains, there's less broadcast traffic in each broadcast domain, which means it can improve performance on each segment. Also makes the machines invisible to others on different network segments. And provides increased security. That's how we keep the salespeople out of our the marketing, or we'll keep the salespeople out of the management section or something. Okay, some of the disadvantages is it requires routing or distribution layer devices. A router can slow traffic between network segments. It's a lot more complex and requires a lot more expense and requires routers. And there you go. What is that? H1, H2 stuff here. So most local networks are based on Ethernet technology. Go ahead, Jay.
Yeah, if you want to go, you can.
We've got somebody leaving.
Okay, so do you want me to go or you...
As far as I know, I'm still well within it. I can't... Okay, basically, there's a few paragraphs here, guys, talking about network planning, plan a local network. Oh, hang on. Oh, is that a heading? Was that a heading, was it?
10-4.
Oh, okay, the document formatting's been completely and utterly mangled. You go, hon. Then so are we up to 3.6, are we?
Yeah, it's an H1. We are. We're at 3.6.
All right, go. Sorry, Jay, because I'm listening to you on Crystal Set Radio at the moment. It seems that the Ventrilo seems to be getting quieter and quieter and quieter. I feel like smashing something today. I wonder what I can break.
Don't know. All right, let's talk about planning.
Don't break Jill's computer. We just fixed it.
Yes, to which I can say thank you for Kylie's help. No, Jill's computer's safe. And that, by the way, is IT1 in action. Kylie was absolutely very helpful to me the other night when we did most of this.
All right, let's talk a little bit about planning a local network. Obviously, if there's, just one or two computers, you probably won't have to plan. But if there are more than that, you're going to have to plan. Basically, the most common technology that you're probably going to be dealing with when planning a local network is Ethernet. Obviously, the key is to plan the network before it's built. You need to take and get information about how the network will be used. Well, information that you need to get are number and type of host to be connected to the network, where are the end users located, what type of hardware are they using, where are the servers, printers, and other devices located, what applications will be used, what type of applications run on the network, data and devices to be shared, who requires access to particular files or resources, such as printers, various types of files, etc. You really don't want HR in the accounting stuff, and vice versa, actually. What about bandwidth requirements? What speeds are acceptable? Do all users require the same speed? For example, some users may just be doing word processing, whereas others may be, watching videos. Obviously, those who are doing videos are going to require larger throughputs. What effect does the applications that are being run on the network have on the throughput? Obviously, if you're trying to load a huge database or whatever, that may considerably slow it down. Security and privacy considerations, we've discussed that. You have to particularly figure out if the data that's being moved is of a personal or sensitive nature that could harm someone were it to fall in the wrong hands. What are the reliability and uptime expectations? How important is it? I mean, it's one thing to have a home network that, could go down for a time and, it's probably not going to be a life or death situation. On the other hand, if it's a medical, like 911 thing, it needs to be available 100% of the time. What about connectivity requirements? Wireless? Can any of the users, do they require wireless connectivity? In other words, if they're on the road, they travel, they need to connect to the office, they may need to do so wirelessly. You need to draw logical and physical topologies. We've talked a little bit about those earlier. The logical consists of, the network usage, and the physical concerns, what's connected to what, etc. It has to do with hardware, MAC addresses. Some things to include when you're drawing up your maps are physical environment. Where is the network to be installed? What about temperature control? Some devices have, specific ranges of temperature and humidity that they need to, fall into, and some of those are more sensitive than others. Available and placement of power outlets. Physical configuration of the network. Physical locations such as routers, switches, and hosts. How are the devices interconnected? Location and length of cable runs. Hardware configuration of end devices like hosts and servers. Now, logical configuration is like location and size of broadcast and collision domains, IP addressing scheme, naming scheme, because remember, like Windows XP, you have to have computer names. Sharing configuration, how are resources shared? Permissions. This is a big diagram here, and I'm not going to do that. Sometimes it's good if you can build a prototype of the network. You can either do this by actually using test equipment in a lab, or you can use Packet Tracer, which is not accessible to us, so we can't use Packet Tracer, unfortunately. We've talked a lot about this multifunction device or service or router, integrated services router. Obviously, the same functionality is required of a small ISR or integrated services router as might be required in the enterprise. So what has happened is that we've integrated several devices such as switch and router and modem, for example, into one device, as well as a wireless access point. These are usually designed for small homes and offices, but even enterprises can use these if they're designed for that. Obviously, you're getting several different devices connected together, but the connection occurs internally. obviously, if a broadcast, for example, is received on a switch port, the ISR forwards it to all ports, including the internal router connection. And the router part of the internal router connection stops the broadcast from going any further. So, for example, if I send out a broadcast message to the computers on my little home network, the router says, "Ah, that's a broadcast message, and I am definitely not going to send this out over the internet," and drops it. The devices that are available for home and small businesses tend to be of lower cost, and they offer things like integrated routing, integrated switching, wireless, and hopefully security. They talk here about the Linksys wireless router and also Cisco router. The problem with these devices is that they represent a single point of failure because individual components cannot be replaced, and as such the whole thing has to be replaced if any one of the components goes bust. Another example of a router they're talking about here is a Cisco Integrated Services router. This is, they offer a wide, you know, range of products, so let's get done with the propaganda. Some of these actually have replaceable or modular components to them, and they do allow they do allow for replacement and upgrade of the components. Okay, you know what? Let me talk to you a little bit about... There's four ports on this...
Must be just about router. There, aren't we, hon?
There's an internet LED that indicates the status of an internet connection. Usually green indicates that a connection has been made with an end device. Red or yellow usually indicates that there's a problem, so think of the stoplight types of situation. Blinking indicates that there's port activity. The rear of the router has an internet port, and that's the port that's connected to the router part of the multifunction device. Usually you'll see this on your router as like a phone jack if it's like DSL, or a cable connector if it's for cable. There is an internal connection from the routing portion of the multifunction device to the switch portion. And so the internet is obviously connected to a different port than is the Ethernet ports are. Okay? Does everybody understand that concept? That there's internal connectivity so that the internet port is actually different from the Ethernet ports?
Yes.
And it's often referred to as the WAN port. So say on Gary's internal router, he'll have his four internals, and he's probably got a WAN port for his surfboard modem to plug into, which is the cable modem.
Obviously, all devices that are connected to the switch port, like the LAN ports on the router, are in the same broadcast domain, and so they all have to have an IP address from the same network. And any device that has a different network, different network address portion, won't be able to communicate. And don't forget about computer names, so you need to use the computer names. IPconfig, they talk a little bit about here, and you'll be doing some of that in labs, and IPconfig and IPconfig-all. One little trick, you can print out your your results of an IPconfig to a text file, and the way that you do this is you say IPconfig or IPconfig/all, and then a greater than sign followed by the file name that you want to print it out to, and then you can study it for later use. You want to document
and stick that in your labs if you want.
Yeah. You want to document network performance once the whole network has been built, and that gives you a determining the baseline. It gives you a baseline, and it is used as an indicator of normal operations. And if things are going, haywire, you can, compare this
the future performance with the baseline to see if there are any issues. Obviously, one of the things that you want to do on a network is to share resources. You need to assign, you know, permissions to specific resources because of security issues. XP uses simple file sharing, and simple file sharing does not allow you to do this, and so it can be disabled under folder options in order to assign, you know, specific access permissions. When that's done, you can assign the following permissions to resources: full control, modify, read and execute, list folder contents, read or write. And so, in other words, if you assign full control, a person can do anything. If you just assign read, then the person can't write and they can't execute stuff, etc. So I don't think that you can disable simple file sharing in Windows XP Home. I think you can in Windows XP Professional, but I don't think you can in Home. I'll have to check on that. Because one of the things that you can do...
You can in Professional, but I'd have to check Home.
Yeah, I don't think so. One of the things that you can do is actually change ownership and stuff, because a lot of problems can be solved being able to do that. You can also map a drive. For example, I could click on shared documents, on Carl's shared document folder, and map it to as a network drive, so that I could have it as like drive I, and it would appear as a drive on my computer as drive I. That's what map, a network drive means.
You'd see it in my computer, and if you're at the command prompt, you could go I colon.
Yeah. The other thing that they show is an icon of a shared folder, and what it shows is a hand holding an open folder. And you should be familiar with what these icons look like, because you may be helping to fix a sighted person's computer. And if they, you know, tell you, well, I have a folder with an open folder, a hand holding an open folder, well, then you know that it's being shared. And we're done. And I'm only 2 minutes overtime. Sorry for the overtime, folks. But considering how late we got started, I think we did PDG.
I think so, and sorry about all the hassles at my end. You know, you sort of trust that Ventrilo will work. You haven't touched it for a week. You turn on and people say, oh, you've got a noise behind you, and you go, what? So we are using the redundant systems today, so that's why I'm always bigger on redundancy. So how's everyone going with this? It's all pretty steep. We're at the end of the first incline in our discovery train journey, and congratulations to all of you who have slugged it out with us.
And you know what, guys? We're here to help you. So, I mean, seriously, if you don't take advantage of that, then, I mean, I'm not going to come knocking on everybody's door and say, "Ooh, can I help you?" No, you guys are big boys and girls, and we expect you to come to us, okay? But having said that, we're here for you, and we'll do whatever we can to help. So either ask us now, ask in an email, or, you know, catch us on Skype or whatever, and we'll try and help if we can. I mean, and we can. I mean, that's why they let us be instructors.
Absolutely. And exactly. And there's also the discussion list, too, if you want to put something out there, because if we don't come back right away, somebody else will. There's plenty of people out there with all too ready to offer advice. So don't feel you're alone out there in networking land, because you're not.
Anybody have any questions for today before we go off and do dinner or whatever it is?
We're cool here. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.